Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the MBTA begins the process of raising fares starting this summer. Also today, driving a car and using cannabis. When exactly is someone too stoned to drive?
You know, we've all heard the catchphrase, treat marijuana like alcohol. But in this particular case with operating under the influence, we can't because they're very different substances.
And we talk with a psychologist about having friends from different races.
Most of us are racial isolationists. We tend to have friends that are of the same race. And so I began to look at why that was so.
Plus, are edited photos on social media causing body image issues?
As a society, I think we're exposed to less and less sort of real and natural photos of our peers.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, riding the MBTA could get more expensive starting this summer. The MBTA's Fiscal and Management Control Board heard plans today to raise ticket fares about 6% across the board. The hikes would be the fourth price increase since 2012. WBUR's Simone Rios was at the meeting this afternoon, and he joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Simone.
Thank you, Deb.
So what exactly are the proposed fare hikes?
Basically, they want to increase fares by an average of 6.3% across the entire MBTA system, but not all services will be affected equally. So let's say you ride the local bus, your fare goes from 170 to 180, that's 10 cents. On the subway, your fare would go up from 225 to 240. The monthly link pass goes up $5.50, and so on. Meanwhile, cash bus fares will stay the same, and there's some changes that one of the ferry services will actually go down somewhat. The MBTA has a calculator up on their website. You can actually go and look at how you'd be affected by the rate hike.
And so why does the MBTA say these increases are needed?
Well, inflation. With inflation, everything gets more expensive with time. And the T's general manager pointed out that the proposed rate hikes are keeping track with inflation. Here he is, the T's new general manager, Steve Poftak.
This is, I think, a modest fare increase. It keeps pace with inflation. I also think doing it on a periodic basis where the rise is not quite so dramatic, you know, I'm hopeful that this lands a little bit easier than in the not-so-distant past where the fare increases were larger.
In all, MBTA officials expect to raise $32 million in new revenue.
Hmm. You know, Simone, this meeting comes on the heels of a report about increased overtime costs for the MBTA. How did officials say, or what did officials say, about where they're seeing these increased costs?
Yeah, so we heard from the T's chief financial officer, Paul Brandley, before the meeting this afternoon. And he told reporters before the meeting that the new revenue is badly needed for a number of reasons.
Come July 1st, a number of our operating budget line items change. And they change because we've got multi-year contracts in place with vendors. We've got collective bargaining agreements that are in place with many of our workforces. We'll see a step up in pension and health care contributions.
So there's a lot going on there. Another obvious liability for the T that we can't forget about is its debt obligation. Brandley told us the organization will pay down $500 million in debt over the coming fiscal year. And that's half interest and half principal.
What was the reaction today? Any opposition?
Well, given people's gripes with how the T operates, you know, it's not something anybody's going to celebrate, the idea of having to pay more to use the T. One of the people at today's meeting who spoke against the hikes was Sarah Levy. She's a transit and environmental justice organizer at the nonprofit Green Roots.
So we expect that you will be creative in finding new ways to bring in revenue other than placing the burden on riders. If you are truly committed to making the T more affordable and equitable, We ask that you take a step in the right direction, harnessing your innovativeness, as opposed to moving in the opposite direction of your stated goals.
Another person who spoke against the tea hikes was recently elected Senator Nick Collins. He represents Dorchester and Mattapan, and he talked about how rate hikes would have a disproportionate impact on low-income people.
With the system continuing to suffer from service and reliability issues, a fare increase would not only be unfair to riders, it would also drive away many potential users and current users from the system, worsening traffic on our roads and driving increased emissions, thereby subverting the mission of public transit.
It's interesting what he says there about decreasing the number of riders. Tea officials actually do expect ridership to go down slightly as a result of the increases, but they think on the whole that they'll benefit.
And what's the timeline now for what might happen with these proposed hikes?
So there's a public comment period that's open until February 28th. And on February 27th, the day before that, there will be a public hearing at the State Transportation Building in downtown Boston. It should be a pretty vibrant meeting. The T is hoping the Fiscal Management and Control Board will vote on the proposed increase in March, and fares would go up on the 1st of July.
All right, WBUR's Simone Rios, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
With marijuana now more available in Massachusetts, when is someone too impaired to drive? That's the question now before state lawmakers. Governor Charlie Baker supports a plan where if someone is suspected of being too high to drive and then refuses to take a chemical test, that person would lose their license for at least 6 months. And that's the same penalty for suspected drunk drivers who refuse a breathalyzer. The plan is from the State Special Commission on Operating Under the Influence and Impaired Driving, and two members of that commission are with us. John Carmichael, police chief in Walpole. Welcome to Radio Boston, Chief.
How you doing? Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. Also with us in studio is criminal defense attorney Peter Ellican. Hi, Peter.
Terrific to be here.
So, Chief, let's start with you. What do you think is the biggest thing that this proposal would change?
All of it. I think it's all very important. The 19 recommendations that were made by the OUI Commission, I think, are all very important and unique in of themselves. And I think that the governor and the lieutenant governor took these recommendations to heart and didn't waste any time in forwarding that through to get it into legislation. You asked me, like, which ones I think are the most important.
No, I'm wondering right now in a typical traffic stop, if there is if an officer thinks that someone may be impaired because of marijuana, what do they do and what would this change?
Yeah, sure. Well, the first thing is that the officers are obligated to remove them from the roadway, right? If they suspect anybody is impaired by any substance, then they're obligated to make sure that they don't let that person continue to drive. And typically what they're looking at is the initial observation of a motor vehicle infraction. They didn't stop for a stop sign, or there's a marked lanes violation, or whatever it might be. They affect that motor vehicle stop, and then, you know, they make observations from that point on, right from the time they walk up to the vehicle, make contact with the operator. And those observations are relative to that person's behavior, their attitude, the demeanor, their attentiveness. A lot of, whatever their signs they're exhibiting to the officer at that time, the officer is taking note of that and then at some point would establish that person may or may not be impaired.
But basically what you're saying here is it's the officer's observation.
Yes. Officer's observations are the initial things of importance, yes.
But under this plan, there would be a chemical test here. So where someone, if they didn't take that chemical test, could lose their driver's license for 6 months.
Correct. And the chemical test will be secondary to what the officer is seeing out on the street. That's, example, the oral fluid test. The officers are taking that information after they've already established probable cause to believe that, that person's impaired, and then they apply any type of, chemical testing that we may adopt, and the goal of that being a confirmation that that person is under the influence of whatever type of substances they have in their system.
Mm-hmm. But at this point, is there a reliable chemical test?
I think so, yeah. We looked at multiple types of specific devices that were out there currently, some that are used by other states. And, you know, we a lot of it, we looked at the sensitivity and the specificity of each of these types of devices. They're not perfect, but they do, I think, give us enough to basically confirm what the officer's observations were out on the street. These devices, you know, contrary to what I hear a lot of, don't say that this is impairment. They are telling us that this person has an active drug or substance in their system, and which could be linked to the impairment that the officer is observing.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it raises all kinds of questions. But first, I want to make sure we get Peter Ellican in here. Peter, your thoughts. You were part of this commission. What do you think should be taken from this report? And do you support this particular proposal?
I support a great deal of it. We were actually in lockstep, the commission, with all kinds of civil liberties groups, defense attorneys, law enforcement people. We were in agreement, first of all, on two things. One is that we really found out that you can't drive as well under the influence of marijuana. And a lot of people said, no, I can focus and concentrate. I actually drive better on marijuana. Every single study said that's just not true. Hmm. The other thing is there was a concern that every state that has legalized marijuana so far has seen the number of accidents go up. So what our commission was tasked with, and again, it's not a question of do we like marijuana or not, should it be legal or not, that's not the issue. The question is there going to be a question with people impaired by it? In the same way that a lot of us may have no problem with legalizing, with the fact that alcohol is legal, we still don't want people drunk driving. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we were tasked with. And we do not have a perfect answer for it at this time. We put together some better guidelines and more stringent requirements, but it's not perfect because at this point we don't have the equivalent of an alcohol breathalyzer where you blow in and you have that 0.08. Mm. We think that there's going to be something like that for marijuana within the next 3 to 5 years. At that point, it will be a lot better. At this point, though, without that, the old expression, well, perfect is the enemy of good. We don't have anything perfect. So we tried to tighten up the law enforcement tools as best we could.
Hmm. So I guess, Chief, my question to you is, okay, we're not saying that this is necessarily impairment, but we found the substances in the system. And, of course, here in Massachusetts, we have the 2017 Supreme Judicial Court ruling that said field sobriety tests are not conclusive evidence of marijuana intoxication. So you've got that legal threshold that might be complicating things as well. And also, with marijuana, stays in your system for a long time, and people might be taking it medically, and just because it's there doesn't mean you're impaired, right? So how do you deal with those questions? I know there's a lot of them, but let's first talk about the issue of impairment.
Yep, sure. Well, so the Gerhardt case did establish that. They said that basically the lay police officer couldn't, you know, determine that a person's the results of a field sobriety test could be testified to in court and that the officer could establish impairment by simply applying those standard field sobriety tests. A more recent case just came out by the SJC, the Davis case, where they took into consideration all the things that I mentioned previously, that, you know, marijuana does cause lack of concentration and problems with divided attention and, you know, that behavior, attitude, demeanor observations that the officer made. So those are all very important, and those all came into play with supporting the fact that the police officer was able to establish impairment just based on those observations alone. So when you look at standard field sobriety testing, or now which we call them roadside assessments, we did look at, in the commission, horizontal gaze nystagmus. We looked at different types of field sobriety testing or roadside assessments that can be applied. And I think that going forward, the research will still have to dictate which direction we go. But I certainly found that, you know, when doing certain tests, for example, the finger-to-nose test, you know, three cues of missing the finger on the nose, modified Romberg, where the officers are looking at eyelid and extremity tremors, one leg stand, walk and turn, those tests, I think, can still be valid and be able to show that there could be impairment, you know, based on adding in a couple of other assessments in that. And then the other thing is we have drug recognition experts, and drug recognition experts can put people through a 12-step process as well to determine impairment.
Well, can I bring something up here? Because we spoke with the ACLU about this last week, Matt Allen with the ACLU of Massachusetts. We asked him about some of these drug recognition exams that we now have. We have a little clip of that interview. Let's listen.
law enforcement agencies have been using a drug recognition examination that has never been scientifically validated. So, you know, it's unfortunate that studies with sound methodologies to validate this exam have never been completed.
So, Chief, what do you say to that?
Well, I think that, you know, this there is still more research that needs to be done on it. However, this test has been used for many years, the drug recognition expert assessments. And while those studies that were done quite some time ago, maybe we need to kind of update those studies more, you know, modernly and deal with it that way. But it's what we have. I mean, right. This is the drug recognition experts are what we have. And they, in many states, drug recognition experts just get up there and testify to their observations. And that was another thing that we actually got in the recommendations that we will, you know, that officers would have the ability to do that. Hmm.
Peter, you represent people who are accused of driving under the influence. Well, I mean, what do you tell them? You know what? We don't really have tests right now. I mean, is it like blanket fight regardless? Because
historically, it has been much easier to get people off on an operating under the influence of any kind of drug or marijuana because, as I said earlier, we don't have the equivalent of a breathalyzer of 0.08. So in the past, when I'm representing somebody charged with operating under the influence of drugs or marijuana, very often we can just get the case dismissed. They really don't have any way to prove it. Those are very beatable cases. So I think that was the concern, that with the legalization of marijuana, we may have many more cases like this. And concerning public safety, is the public going to be further endangered? And again, as we keep saying, there's no perfect result until we get that equivalent of the breathalyzer, which for marijuana, which is 3 to 5 years away. There are things they can do to firm up, and that is what I would say would be more drug recognition experts, better testing and better sort of guidelines for the police, better training. There's a bunch of things. And even then, it's going to fall short, and it's not going to be that perfect answer that we're searching for. So I think this commission came up with a lot of improvements. But if you say, okay, is that it? Is that settled? Is that the best we can do? And I'd say no, still 3 to 5 years off probably.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation here, Ann Kitch. She tracks the marijuana and driving issue for the National Conference of State Legislatures. She's joining us from Colorado. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Deborah. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. I'm wondering if you can tell us if we don't necessarily have a perfect system right now. I mean, what advice do you give states in terms of how to deal with this issue?
Yeah. So, and as Peter mentioned, the system is not perfect. There is no definitive research that shows which law is most effective. And so currently we're seeing states such as Massachusetts and Colorado really dig into that state level data and the citation data to kind of determine, you know, what methods we can use to determine if a person is impaired by marijuana usage. And so I'd say that the states that are really analyzing this issue are definitely producing some of our most current and potentially accurate evidence. But that as of now, I'd say has been probably just the law that's been at the forefront.
You know, Peter, you mentioned something, and I've heard different things about this. You said every state that's legalized marijuana has seen an increase in highway-related incidents of people driving under the influence. Is that right?
Yeah, those are the initial studies, and I don't know how perfect every one of the studies is, but they seem pretty much in lockstep, I thought. I hadn't heard of anything.
So can we ask Ann about that? Ann, is the data showing that?
So as of now, there is no definitive data that is showing that, but I think over the next couple of years, it will be interesting to see if we do identify or uncover such data. So, I'd say over the next hopefully year or two, we'll know a little bit more about that landscape.
So I wonder if we don't have a perfect test, as we're saying right now, and we're estimating, Peter says, 3 to 5 years it's out before we have a test that might be sort of a marijuana breathalyzer, if you will. Is blood test typically what is done to confirm the presence of a substance in most states, Ann?
So currently, the most common methods are through blood, urine, or saliva. If a person refuses to submit a chemical test, then there is the next option to receive a warrant for the blood test. But that varies state by state.
Okay. So at this point, in terms of looking at this from a national perspective, are you looking at ways to make sure that states would have a uniform way of testing and agreeing upon what constitutes impairment?
So we're not currently looking at that. We're digging into what states are doing, such as these roadside saliva pilot tests and things like that, and what sanctions states are imposing if those tests are refused. Hmm.
And is anyone doing something similar to Massachusetts? I read in Michigan there's zero tolerance for any cannabis in the system at all.
Yes, that's a great question. Massachusetts, along with 31 other states and D.C., actually all have that similar driving under the influence of drugs law, and that a person is prohibited from driving under the influence or affected by THC. And then you have other states who have enacted per se laws that have established a legal THC limit. And then you have a handful of states that have enacted zero tolerance laws that prohibit any amount of THC in a person's body while they're driving.
Even if it's medically prescribed?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder, and what about agreement on drug recognition officers who might testify? Is there uniform agreement about how these officers might be trained and then utilized to testify in driving under the influence cases?
So as far as I know, and just speaking with enforcement officers who have been through those DRE trainings, as Chief Carmichael and Peter both mentioned, it is best left up to the enforcement officer's judgment and the training. They rely on the training that they received in those DRE courses.
Okay, Ann. Well, Ann Kitch tracks marijuana and driving for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'd like to have both Peter and Chief Carmichael weigh in now in terms of what are the outstanding concerns that you still have and you think need to be dealt with by the legislature. Peter, you first.
Yeah, as I said, though, we have this outstanding concern that we don't have a perfect answer. We don't have, you can detect marijuana in a person's system, but marijuana lasts for 30 days, and it's one of the longer lasting drugs. And so when you test somebody, can you really say they're impaired, or were they, did they smoke marijuana 3 weeks ago before they were driving? So I keep saying we do not have the perfect answer. And I think until the science catches up, at that point, we'll have a perfect answer. Right now, all we can do is make the system better and make enforcement a little more accurate, but we're not quite there yet. And everybody's doing the very best that they can with the state of the art, but the science is not there yet. It will be there soon.
Mm-hmm. And Chief, how about you? Do you think that we will soon start to see that folks, if they do refuse a chemical test when they're pulled over for driving under the influence of marijuana, that they will lose their license for 6 months?
Yeah, they would. And again, that's a non-criminal administrative issue with the Registry of Motor Vehicles, just like refusing to take a breath test. So that's, you know, having a driver's license is obviously a privilege. And if people that don't want to comply with the implied consent law would rightfully have to lose their driver's license. So, like, I guess in closing, you know, we hear this catchphrase, treat marijuana like alcohol. And we've heard alcohol get mentioned several times during this conversation. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things we need to do is move away from that. We need to treat marijuana like other drugs and not like alcohol, because we don't have a breathalyzer test for heroin. We don't have it for cocaine or oxycodone. We don't have it for polydrug use. All we have is what the officer's observations are out in the street, and then some confirmatory test afterwards that's going to show that this person had these types of drugs in their system at the time. We don't need to have the discussion about, you know, what if they have a drug in their system from 3 weeks ago, because somebody that has a drug in their system from 3 weeks ago is not going to be weaving all over the road. They won't have glassy bloodshot eyes. They won't have the odor of marijuana smoke coming out of the vehicle. Those observations won't be there. So that's just not really an issue. And the other thing is that when we do test for even using oral fluid. We're testing for hydroxy-THC or active delta-9-THC, the active drug that would be in that system, which would not last in the typical person's body for even close to 3 weeks or a month. That's usually metabolized THC.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for active THC in proximity to the stop, based in addition to the other observations that are made, and giving the officer something to testify later to in court. They're obligated to remove people from the roadway, and we want to make sure that they have the right tools to do that.
Okay, Walpole Police Chief John Carmichael, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Criminal defense attorney Peter Ellican, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
They're both members of the State Special Commission on Operating Under the Influence and Impaired Driving. Stay with us. Coming up, how friendship patterns affect the racial divide. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, it's a phrase many of us have probably heard, maybe even said, when talking about people who are different from us. Some of my friends are... fill in the blank. A new book takes a different spin on that phrase, exploring the challenges of cross-racial friendships. Professor Deborah Plummer is the author of that book. She's a psychologist and professor and vice chancellor, chief diversity officer at UMass Medical School and UMass Memorial Healthcare, and she's in our studios. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Now, you wrote this book, which is titled Some of My Friends Are, The Daunting Challenges and Untapped Benefits of Cross-Racial Friendships, because you said you realized that many people didn't have friends of different races. So what did you find?
I really found that that was true. Actually, it began as a research project, or actually out of my curiosity, because my good friend, who has a similar background, who's African-American, said to me one time on a walk, you know, why do you have so many white friends? And I thought, why don't you have white friends? And I thought she was the outlier, but my research showed that I was the outlier.
Right. And mm-hmm. So why? Why does that seem to be the case?
Yeah. I think it's because, first of all, you know, we suffer from, we live racially segregated. Spatial racism exists. That would be the case even in Boston, where we have racially and economically segregated sections. And so we don't cross, we don't have opportunities to cross racial lines and friendships. You know, there are other factors as well, the demographics, sheer demographics. There are more whites than people of color. You add that with the segregation, you put personal choice. You know,
And what about, you know what you wrote about in the book that I found fascinating, sort of psychologically how tribal we can be.
Exactly.
And explain that a little bit.
The fact that, you know, we like to be with people who look like us, talk like us, think like us. Mm-hmm. And we make that assumption because, first of all, there's a visibility of race. So when we see someone who visually shares our same racial identity, we make the assumption that they're going to have those same values and attitudes and that the world is evoked from them, the same kind of things that it evokes from, you know, from you. And
right.
It's easier then you don't have to deal with all of those things like racism or even microaggressions or all of the other host of interactions that come from the racial dynamics in the United States.
So if people are to have cross-racial friendships, it's work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's definitely work, you know. And we have very busy lives and, you know, we only have so much time, discretionary time for our friendships. And so to cross racial lines, as people tell me, you know, when they want to be in their, when they want to go quick and deep, in other words, when they just want to get to the, the meat of things or they just want to have a good old time, you know, they're going to go with people who share their same race.
Right. So what do we do about that?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that this is the case. So part of the reason why I wrote the book was so that people could examine their own friendship patterns and why that's so, and then look to see, you know, what we are doing to contribute to the racial divide or lessening of it. And that could be, you know, by cross-racial friendships. So we have to, first of all, understand ourselves as a racial being, mm-hmm. you know, do our own racial identity self-assessment. Right. We have to make choices around multiracial living patterns, where we shop, where we go to eat, where we, you know, how we vote, how we interact, who we buy goods from, you know, who are professional, who we choose for our doctors, or, you know, all of those things become part of our multiracial living. And we can address racism.
And that's the benefit. Why should I do all of this work, Professor? Why should people do this work to have cross-racial friendships?
I think, first of all, it helps us to be more fully and authentically who we are as human beings. It gets to the core of that. Mm-hmm. You know, then it also supports us to have a more of a informed citizenry so that we understand what the dynamics are as an American particularly, and then even global, as a global citizen, when we bump up against those differences, it does allow us to grow and to understand not only ourselves, but understand others.
You know, you talked about the 2016 presidential election in your book, and I want to play a pretty well-known clip of President Trump when he was on the campaign trail in 2016. Let's listen.
We had an African-American guy who was a fan of mine. Great fan. Great guy. In fact, I want to find out what's going on with him. You know what I'm... look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest? Do you know what I'm talking about?
And that is then presidential candidate Trump talking about a man named Gregory Cheadle when he was on the campaign trail in 2016. I'm wondering, Professor Plummer, how prevalent do you think that type of tokenism is, and what does that do in cross-racial relationships and friendships?
Unfortunately, it's probably more prevalent than we think, because if you ask most white Americans and if they have friends of a different race, they will tell you yes. But it's probably due to the fact that they really, you know, that they really don't know them. There's a whole continuum from, you know, just knowing someone who, you know, like I call it the Pomeranian's dog's mom that's on the street, or somebody who sat next to them in high school that they recall. We found that out a lot about the research. But the 3 a.m. friend, the person that you can call, generally not our same race. So what we heard President Trump say is what people generally do. They think, okay, I've got a black friend, or look at my that identifier. But the first thing, when you're identifying just the race, then we know that that's probably not a friendship.
Yeah. And then, you know, to build deeper friendships, I mean, that's, you know, how do folks go about doing that when you're in a situation where conversations about race or race, how race influences things, can be minefields? So mm-hmm. how do you deal with that to still have an emotionally honest and deep relationship with someone when you're dealing with such a sensitive subject?
It's a very prickly topic, and I talk a lot about that in the book. I even use my own example of a case study of my own friends of, you know, early high school, you know, and my longest-term white friends. And it was only in preparation for this book, actually, that we began to talk about race, you know, really talk about race, because mm-hmm. as focus group participants have said to me, you know, people of color tend to be the safe friend. You know, we both collude in this dance, so to speak, mm-hmm. that we do with friendships. We don't want to hurt each other's feelings, and we want to preserve the friendship. But it has to be what I call gentle bumping. You know, we can't do it all at once because it is such a prickly topic.
So what happened in your own friendships when you were dealing with this for this book? What happened? Like, tell us the story.
I have two friends, Joan and Rita, who I've known since freshman year in high school, mm-hmm. and we are still friends today. And I told them, you know, I was going to be writing this book, and could I use our friendship as a case example? And that would mean that we would have to have these conversations about race. And so we actually scheduled them and sat down and talked about them. And they were very painful in many respects, because there were differences, particularly with my good friend Joan. You know, she voted for Trump, You know, she's had a very different worldview. Although we have shared similar situations in growing up, race leads me to a different spot. Her deep religious faith leads her to a different spot. You know, so we had some very real conversations about this. When she read the draft, she said to me, I wasn't sure if we were going to end up being friends by the end. And I said to her, I wasn't sure either, but we are working on, you know, this. But we've come to a deeper and a better understanding. And I think it's a much better relationship as a result.
Right. How do you avoid it, avoid cross-racial friendships of becoming almost transactional on both sides for both people who want, you know, whatever they're looking for and to get to the depth that you're talking about?
You know, I have come to realize that all racial, cross-racial friendships do give us, you know, they do speak to the promise or the opportunity for racial harmony and for racial equity. However, not all cross-racial friendships help to heal the divide. And that those of the heart friends that I call them are those deep ones. They take a lot of work. I have three case examples in the book, but those are not, you know, those are not common by any means. Most people have the bubble ones, what I call that they utopian that they think, or they're the calendar friends, or they're just the fellowship friends.
Right.
You know, but first of all, not to expect like to jump in. That's probably the way to antagonize, you know, or not start a good friendship if you say, let's have these deep conversations about race and racism. It's not going to happen.
I don't think so. Let's start easy. So start easy and see where it goes from there. Right?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And do the things you love. And, you know, and if you have multiracial living, you're going to automatically meet people who are different of different race.
Which is an issue in this area
in terms of
diversity.
So, it truly is.
That makes it so we have a tough road, but we can do it. As we only have about 30 seconds left. Would that be your parting words of wisdom?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Professor Deborah Plummer, psychologist and author of the book, Some of My Friends Are, The Daunting Challenges and Untapped Benefits of Cross-Racial Friendships. She's also Vice Chancellor and Chief Diversity Officer for UMass Medical School and UMass Memorial Healthcare. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, can social media cause body image problems? I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A psychiatric disorder combined with social media has coined a relatively new term. It's Snapchat dysmorphia, and it refers to the effects that social media can have on body image issues. Joining us to talk about this is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Deb, and don't feel bad if you haven't heard that term before. It really is pretty new. It's just been gaining ground in the last few months.
Okay, well, that makes me feel better. So let's break it down a bit. Snapchat, I get. It's probably shorthand for other social media platforms like Instagram.
Yep.
So let's start by talking about dysmorphia.
So that's connected to an official psychiatric disorder. It's called body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD. And that involves an abnormally high level of distress and preoccupation with what you see as flaws in your appearance.
Well, just everybody might wish they could change their appearance in some way, right? So when is it at the point that it's considered a mental health issue?
Well, you know, as you can imagine, our current culture has people constantly posting their own selfies, seeing other people's selfies, often doctored using filters and photo editing tools. And so that can really play into this syndrome, which is body dysmorphic disorder.
So selfies. It's over the top. Selfies are believed to be helping to cause more body dysmorphic disorder.
Well, so we don't have data on that. But I spoke with Mass General Hospital psychologist Hillary Weingarten. She says we do see selfies interact with the disorder. She says, just speaking anecdotally, technology and social media are kind of intertwining with body dysmorphic disorder patients' symptoms and rituals.
In the past, a BDD patient might have gone to the bathroom to check his or her appearance in the mirror many times throughout the school day or work day. And now we're seeing a lot of patients who are replacing some of that with taking selfies repeatedly for sometimes up to hours on end throughout the day. So it's become a pretty pervasive ritual that's kind of on hand at all times.
And she says social media also play into patients' symptoms in that if you, let's say you post a photo and then you don't get a lot of likes or shares or other negative responses that can exacerbate feelings of rejection. And Weingarten says, you know, social media use is even shaping what it seems normal to look like.
As a society, I think we're exposed to less and less sort of real and natural photos of our peers. And we're seeing more and more photos that our peers have doctored up behind the scenes with filters and, you know, editing. And so when we look at these pictures that our friends are posting on social media, they often look so perfect.
And, you know, in the past, we knew celebrities were being photoshopped, but now it's our peers. So she says that can really amp up the belief that we need to look perfect in our everyday life.
Not exactly real. So you're finding, or someone is, I mean, doctors are saying that there are a lot of people that are trying to look like they do in doctored selfies?
Yes. And so Weingarten and colleagues have just published a brief practical guide in the journal JAMA Facial Surgery for cosmetic surgeons on how to recognize and treat patients whose appearance issues seem to rise up to this level of actually being body dysmorphic disorder. And in it, they cite these reports. Again, it's only anecdotal, but that cosmetic surgeons are increasingly being asked by patients to help them look the way they look with these Snapchat or Instagram filters.
Now, you know, I thought these filters like added cute animal ears or yes. flower crowns, right?
They do, but they can also make your eyes or your lips bigger or your skin look perfect or your nose look smaller. I spoke with Dr. Neelam Vashi, who is an associate professor of dermatology at Boston University. She wrote about this Snapchat dysmorphia stuff last year, and she says, you know, it used to be cosmetic surgery patients would come in asking to look like, say, Angelina Jolie, or they'd say, I want to look like that. Then 4 or 5 years ago, her first patient came in with a selfie.
And then now it's patients bringing in their own photographs of themselves, but saying, I want to look better in this picture that I post to the world, or I want to look like this altered image of myself. Can you make me look more like this? This is what I want to look like.
So in other words, they want to look like enhanced photos of themselves. And also, Deb, they want to look better in their selfies, which she says can be problematic because, you know, selfies are often taken at very strange angles. And if you really looked like your enhanced selfie, you would look very strange in real life. Like, for example, a selfie makes your nose look bigger. If you wanted to be smaller, you'd have to have a very abnormally small nose.
Oh, I'm getting a headache. But OK, we're in a social media world, though, and we know that it's already common to find fault with your own appearance. So how do people know when they might be going too far?
Well, first of all, chances are you're in the realm of the normal. Like the estimates are that only about 2% of the population really has this disorder and about 13% of the people who seek cosmetic surgery. But in the surgery office, Weingarten and her colleagues suggest that the surgeons should use a sort of formal screening questionnaire. And Dr. Vashi also suggests that surgeons start with a simple set of questions.
Do you think about your appearance a lot and wish you could think about it less? Does it upset you a lot? Has it caused you problems with work or your school or relationships? Are there things you avoid because of your appearance? These few questions are fast, they're very simple, and you can just get kind of the gestalt of the patient. And if they say, yeah, I cry every day, well, that is a sign that maybe then take it to the next level and give them the questionnaire.
Because if they do have this body dysmorphic disorder, that means cosmetic surgery might very well not help them.
Because it's a psychological problem.
Right. You're not going to fix it with a scalpel. And, you know, the good news is there is treatment for body dysmorphic disorder, so that can be effective.
Mm-hmm. And that's cognitive behavioral therapy. Is that right?
Right. Like, that often involves reality checking your thoughts, facing situations you tend to avoid. And Weingarten says there's even what's called perceptual retraining.
Mm. Okay. Well, Kerry Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to her story on our website, radioboston.org. Kerry, thanks.
You're welcome.
Finally today, what are your questions about technology? Maybe you can't get your Wi-Fi router to work right, or maybe you uploaded your photos and now you can't find them. Or maybe you're trying to figure out how to tell that Facebook friend to tone it down without becoming a social media sensation yourself. Any of these scenarios sound familiar? Well, WBUR is working on a show to help connect you with some personalized tech support. It's a new show about technology, the perils, the problems, and sometimes the pleasures. And here to tell us more are two of the people working on the show, Radio Boston producer Jamie Bologna. Hi there, Jamie.
Hey, Deb.
And former Radio Boston producer Allison Bruzek. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Deb.
So what's the most common tech problem that people seem to have?
I think the most common one that we've seen is for the smart speaker. So the
Amazon Alexa, the Google Home. People have a lot of questions about how often it's listening, what it's keeping when it's listening, and what they need to be worried about.
So that brings me to my tech question, because I have this question. I'm constantly paranoid about technology. Now, don't even make paranoid jokes, but surveillance on the web. I mean, I use my phone, I use my computer, I've got my laptop at work, my laptop at home, and you know, being a journalist, you search for all kinds of things, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And I find that these things are always following me on the web, and it makes me really uncomfortable.
Deb, what do you mean by things that are following you?
So I'm not doing a good job here
trying to avoid the paranoia jokes. By figuring out what you mean.
Help us help you.
Okay. Well, so I'm doing a story about bankruptcy, or I'm doing a story about cancer drugs, or whatever I'm doing a story about, and I'll search in one place, maybe even my desktop, and suddenly Facebook knows. And they're telling me, oh, do you need this cancer drug? Do you need a bankruptcy attorney? Are you looking for rehab? And I've got all of these things following me. It seems almost instantaneously. So I want to know, how can I use the internet to search for things and not feel like I'm being followed?
Well, I have some questions for you first. What browser are you using and what kind of phone do you have?
I have an iPhone and I'm typically using Chrome.
Okay. And on your iPhone, do you have location settings on?
I try to turn them off. I think I'm being so sophisticated.
But what apps are you using? Do you have Facebook on your phone?
I do.
Do you have Instagram on your phone?
I do.
Do you have WhatsApp on your phone?
I do.
Oh, no.
You're not trying that hard. Because all those apps...
I knew it was going to come back to me. It's like it always comes back to the mom,
it does.
Right?
I'm not blaming you, but all of those apps are owned by Facebook, and they submit all of that information right back to Facebook. Everything that you're doing on your phone, online, they're tracking you. They're creating a dossier because you're the product for Facebook, Google, Amazon.
Okay, how do I stop them?
Well, I have a couple of suggestions for Deb. One way you can protect yourself is actually by using something other than Google when you're doing your searches. So I'm going to recommend a different kind of search engine. It's called DuckDuckGo. So it's Duck, D-U-C-K, D-U-C-K, Go. It's actually a play on DuckDuckGoose. And you can change it to be your default search engine. So every time you're looking for something, rather than going to google.com, you'll go to duckduckgo.com. And the great thing about it is that it doesn't collect any private information.
So they say.
So they say. But basically, and I've found this to be the case, when I search anything, I never get followed by anything that I'm looking for. So I can look up different kinds of candy, or what is the oxygen level on the moon, or you know,
those
and I'm
are
not
things
get...
you typically look up, right, Alex?
Those are the things that I'm looking for, yes. And I never get followed by spacesuits or anything from the Mars brand.
Uh-huh.
Like, it actually is very effective, I've found. And so that's one thing.
But this will only help you with your search. I mean, any right. website that you go to that has a Facebook or Twitter or Google Share button on the top of it, it's something like 8 million websites have this on it. Those are all being tracked by Facebook, even if you're not logged in. So I just say, you know, just embrace it, Deb. Just love Big Brother. He's here to help.
What?
No, you know, maybe
no,
you
did no,
you
Deb, read don't listen to Orwell? That.
I did, and it's kind of too late.
There's nothing we can do. Should I get off Facebook forever? Does
There's
it
a
matter?
Lot you can do. You
Does
can only
matter?
Use cash. You could, you know, you have a burner phone. You could do as Allison says and switch your default search engine. You can get a new browser, use Linux on your computer. But are you going to do all those things?
Oh, come on.
I'm going to give Deb one more suggestion in order to fight the good fight and do not give people more information than they need. So
okay.
This is something that you're going to install on your browser. So like there are like add-ons for different browsers, whether you're running Internet Explorer or Google Chrome or Safari or Firefox. This is something you add to that, and it's called Ghostery. So it's like ghost, like G-H-O-S-T-E-R-Y. So you go to ghostery.com, and it says install. And what this does is, we're talking about Facebook, it'll actually block those Facebook trackers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you go to Facebook and then you go somewhere else and then Facebook is tracking you wherever you go, this will actually stop those trackers from following you.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm rolling my eyes here, Allison, because
this is all
well and good, but the companies are always going to be a step ahead of us here, and they're 15 steps ahead of regulation, so... Sure, you can try that, Deb, but they're going to be following you.
So there's nothing
Jamie's
you
so
can
pessimistic.
Do.
Really? No, there's. You should do all of these things. They will help, but I think the cat's out of the barn. What's the saying here, Alice?
the cat's out of the bag.
The cat's
out of the barn.
So seriously, why don't you tell us how folks can ask you about solving their technology problems?
Well, they can pick up their encrypted phone and dial 617-917-4717, and they can leave us a message, and we'll get back to them with our help.
All right. Producers Jamie Bologna and Allison Bruzek, the show they're working on with WBUR is called No Signal. If you have a tech-related issue that you want some help with, call them at 617-917-4717. That's 617-917-4717. Allison, Jamie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deb.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukov, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hatti. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.